Hello, personal and professional development enthusiasts. Today I have a very special guest on the podcast, and if you run a business, I encourage you to listen because Giulio Segantini is here, who's going to tell us all about cold calling and about getting clients on the phone. Welcome to the show, Giulio.
Thanks for having me, mate. It's always good to talk to you.
Yes, likewise, likewise. It's great to talk to you always, and it's no secret. We have known each other for a while now, and I'm really excited to have this conversation with you where you can share your journey a little bit about my audience as well, how you got into this and what drives you.
I think that's the first thing, how I got into this. Obviously, I don't have very good skills. Otherwise, why the hell would I be cold calling, right? That's a running joke. Cold calling is like the bottom of the food chain in sales. No one wants to do it.
So how did you get started with cold calling?
It's like what most people fall into sales, right? I was looking for a job in HR, ended up doing recruitment. And then turns out recruitment is a sales job. And yeah, in June, it'll be 11 years ago. And yeah, you just called people all day, essentially. That's how I got accustomed. We used to have one of those handset phones.
A dial-up machine where you had to like ring.
The big red ones, exactly.
And then the other person at the other end of the White House would answer like, hello.
Oh, no, they would actually be redirected, right? You would be speaking like first, hello, can I speak to the Queen, please? That's how it goes, right?
Wow.
No, I'm joking.
So when you got into this cold calling, like, what was your first impression? Like, you got into it straight out of university, if I'm not mistaken, is that right?
Yeah, literally coming out of uni, I literally got right away into a sales job. And to be honest, I don't think it's as bad as people think it is. At the end of the day, you are literally paid to talk to people. The real problem is like, it's like the quality of the people making cold calls is so low, generally speaking, because it's not something that people jump up and down to do, that the overall customer experience or prospect experience is poor. It doesn't mean it has to be. It's a little bit like Fiat, right? Generally make terrible cars. Doesn't mean all Italian cars are bad. You can get also Lamborghini and Ferrari, but if you're thinking about Italian cars, you're thinking about Fiat. And if you think about cold calling, generally you're thinking about, someone's going to try and push me to buy something I don't want, but it doesn't have to be that way.
To address the elephant in the room right away, there is a huge stigma around cold calling where people hate to be bothered unexpectedly by sales calls. From your perspective as an employee, you pay to have a conversation with people, but then on the customer side, what's their experience generally?
I think the first thing to understand is the difference between B2C and B2B calls. So I think the vast majority of the public perceives cold calling as the guy trying to sell you like Vodafone or insurance, right? And that's like literally even within the cold calling, that would be the bottom of the barrel. So that's just like someone with 300 phone numbers a day just calling, repeating the same thing over and over. So I would say that's the first thing. So the public's opinion is a bit tilted because of that. Most people that are in B2B, so like most people with a budget, like they buy stuff, that they are not as against cold calling as you would think. So to give you an idea, I work exclusively Anglo-Saxon markets, which is probably the most saturated markets in the world, right? UK and US. And you would think that people are very averse to cold calls. Do you know what's the most typical response I get whenever I introduce myself?
What was the most typical response?
What do you sell?
Really? People ask you that?
So I go for the pattern interrupt, which is like something like, look, I'm going to be honest, this is a sales call. And then I make it a little bit funny. I say, do you want to throw your phone out the window or let me have 30 seconds? It's completely up to you, right? Just to break the tension a bit. And you have statistically 20% of people that just say no. But that's it.
Like,
and they'd be like, no, It's very rare they're really rude. Like, rude, I would say, is 1 out of 20. So 5%.
Okay.
From my statistical experience. But yeah, I would say 1 out of 5 is, it's either don't have time or whatever, but they politely decline the call. But the vast majority, 10%, is like, yeah, go on, tell me. Very open to it. And then you got the other 70%. That depends what you're selling. Because they do know that you could be selling something interesting for them.
That's very interesting. So you mentioned that there is a differentiation between B2C and B2B cold calling. Mm-hmm. And the stigma is the insurance cold callers, or what used to happen is people selling investment, forex, trading, etc. That was the most common one until GDPR, and even a little bit after, they were still pushing on with that agenda. And of course, you as a cold calling trainer, you focus on B2B cold calling, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. First of all, cold calling is not for everyone. I want to make that very clear, in the sense that it's not every business needs it. So for example, if you are targeting very small deals, let's say you're a company, I don't know, Descript, which is a software I use for videos, their average license is like $15, $30. So it would be mental for them to call companies to get 5 licenses, right? Because that's not enough value. But maybe for very big licenses, so if they wanted to get 100 plus users, then it could make sense. So I would say, in order to consider cold calling, your average customer value should be $5K plus. So if you're not at least making $5K from a customer, it just doesn't make any sense time-wise. But if you're making $5K and above, then it starts to become exceptionally good. How many emails have you received from people trying to sell you something today?
Like a lot. Like really, obviously, companies are marketing via email. They send in the promotional email. So I actually have a dedicated account where I receive the promotional emails, and the business emails are completely separated. That is for communication only.
But I think you probably get, this is things you signed up for. Like once you say you're an HR of a corporate with 200 employees, you're going to get probably 100 plus cold emails a day. And you're likely going to get 2-3 cold calls. Actually, that's probably too much already. But maybe you get those in a week. So if you're sending an email, you're 1 out of 500 in a week. If you're cold calling, you're 1 out of 5. Which one do you prefer?
Well, then if you cold call for businesses, then typically... Mm-hmm. Historically, there was this like gatekeepers in the companies who are dedicated to not let people get through to the decision makers, so that the decision makers can conduct their daily business uninterrupted. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
Look, first of all, my general recommendation is to not deal with it. So the technology these days is good enough that you can get a lot of mobiles. My target market, which is like SMEs, I get 60-65% of mobiles without going crazy. So that means why the hell would I go through the reception? Even if I get put through, I have a chance the person is not going to pick up the phone anyway, right? So I'm way better off getting data, like it's in terms of cost effectiveness. So that the first thing I would say, if you're going to cold call, is get a really good list together and get together a minimum level of tech, which is really cheap, so that you don't have to spend time doing crap tasks. It's like the equivalent of thinking about writing emails one by one or putting something together so you can send hundreds at the same time, right? So I would say that's a level one. Try not to pass the reception. If you do have to, I personally have a very contrarian approach to most sales trainer, which is try to make friends with the reception, because most people will tell you to try and bully them or try and come across very authoritative so that they put you through. The problem is that if your accent is even a little bit conspicuous, that's never going to work, because they're going to clock you the next time. The next time I'll be like, you're that person. If you're so important, you don't have to direct dial the person or whatever. So I would say just try to make friends. It's like starting with something like, hey, look, I was wondering if you could help me. Ask for their name. I say, hey, Mike, look, I was wondering if you can help me. I'm typically working with these problems. I understand the gym would be the right person to talk to. Is that correct? And they usually say, yes, no, okay, can you put me through to them? And that would be that. I would deal with that so-called gatekeeper.
Thank you for sharing that. That certainly sounds very interesting. Now, you mentioned something that you usually dial direct numbers and you get the mobiles. Is that even legal?
That's a very good question. And the good thing about it is that you don't have to care because you're not getting the data yourself. You're buying the data from a third party. How they obtain the data, it's up to them. But typically, they don't obtain it legally. Like they go like references schemes, so people share them. They buy themselves from database, etc. You're just getting people's, you buy the data as it is. And then the burden of that is not on you. Even according to GDPR in Europe, which in US is not even that type of problem, there's nothing that could possibly go wrong from that perspective.
And as far as I understand, like according to GDPR, like business to business outreach is actually legitimate.
Of course.
Right.
How would we run business?
The GDPR only protects private individuals and their privacy, if I'm not mistaken.
When GDPR came out in Europe, everyone was panicking about it, but it's just, honestly, it doesn't really impact the way you run business to business relationships, that's for sure.
So you get the direct numbers for the company owners or the people that you need to talk to, the decision makers, and then you ring them up. And then you say, generally, you get quite a bit of interest about what are you selling. So where do you go from there?
It's one of the most important parts of the call. What people would call the pitch, for me, it's more like a problem statement. So human beings are wired to be twice as likely to move away from problems than towards pleasure, which is the reason why you should be selling solution to problems rather than selling a benefit, because you're going to get twice as likely the chances of closing deals, of getting interest, etc. So typically, what you want to do is you want to target a specific niche or whatever is your target audience, and you want to find what are the 1-2 problems, maximum 3, that you or your company fix and make it very visceral for them. So make it in a very clear problem statement. So I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm calling a founder of a B2B company that's got like a team of 10, 15 salespeople. So my intro will go something like this. I typically work with founders that've got a great sales team in place, but they are concerned by a couple of problems that they see. The first one is that the salespeople are hiding behind emails and LinkedIn instead of picking up the phone, especially the new generations. Or alternatively, they are picking up the phone, but the quality of the conversations they're having leave a lot of room for improvement, meaning that potential clients are lost into a pipeline because of that. So this is two very clear problems they will be feeling. And then I will go with what I call a contrarian statement, which is about, now this is probably what you tell me, that you've got the opposite problem. Your team are such good cold callers that all you got to do is find them more leads. So you almost go the other way to get them to contradict you. And if they don't contradict you, they don't have that problem. You disqualify and you move on. But obviously, that's a conversation starter.
Once you identify this problem statement that you mentioned and the problem resonates with them, you said that most of them are curious what you're selling. So if, let's say, you hit the nail on the head, how do they tend to respond?
I'm going to answer that. I just want to make one quick bracket that will be useful for many people listening, because this is also a very good opener for your discovery calls. So one of the things I see a lot founders or coaches or salespeople do, they'll start a discovery call or the first meeting just by talking a lot about themselves. And instead, it's always better to talk about the problems you fix. So that's, I'm closing that. And then going out, how people tend to respond, like typically you'll get like a good 50%. They'll be like, so what is it that you do? Or then you're going to get others saying everyone has got those problems. They're the best ones usually. And then you get another percentage that will be like, actually, no, you're right. I don't have this problem at all. And then you still want to make sure that's the case before you disqualify him.
That sounds really ethical, like that you make the problem statement. If people have those problems and they're curious about receiving help, then you pursue it. If they're not, you call it disqualification, you disqualify them and you let it go, you leave them alone. You don't try to force them to buy something they don't need.
I mean, look, forcing people to buy is stupid as hell. It's just not going to happen. Like, people don't spend money unless they want to anyway. So this all Grant Cardone, like push, it's very 80s and it's just working less and less, luckily. But what you really want to do is that sometimes people will give you, like, they won't believe you. So people are built in with biases, right? And they might have the problem, but they don't want to admit to it, right? Because this is quite common in therapy as well. Like, you don't immediately open up to your therapist. You're very careful about what you say. Sometimes people will say, oh, no, we're good, or I'm fine. And I think it's important to at least try to make one more attempt to qualify whether that's the case. So there's actually a video published on TikTok where the guy goes, oh, no, we're good. And I'm like, okay. And his tone is a bit weird. So I'm like, okay, do you mind if I ask a question? When you say you're good, it means you don't have this problem, or you just don't trust that someone calling you out of the blue can fix it. And after I say this, the guy completely changes the conversation, because it's the latter. I get a lot of these calls. So you got to keep in mind, even when you jump on a discovery call, is people are not going to come there and just give you away all of the stuff. They're going to want to find out first whether it's worth doing it. So it's important that you try and still qualify them before giving up entirely.
It's fascinating to me to hear that so much empathy and consideration and really this active listening goes into the sales methodologies that you apply. Obviously, everybody is familiar with the heart pressure sales tactics that was formerly used in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then later by the Forex companies, they were trying to pressure you over the phone to make a small investment that gradually got bigger and bigger. But it sounds like you're taking a very different approach.
Look, let's put it this way. And this is something very important for anyone learning sales, is everything works in sales. So you could have the worst opener, you could come across confused, you can come across very authoritative, you can bully people, everything works. So the point is that what you want is you want to have the highest return of investment on your time and effort. If you're trying to push people a lot, you will get some deals through, some of which will come back later, changing their minds because you pushed them, etc. Some of which will have then very high expectations because you pushed so hard, you sold so much. Some of which will just be fine. But the point is, how much work are you going to have to do to get, let's say, an output of 10? If your multiplier is very low, then you're going to have to do a really high volume. My logic is I want to do as little volume as possible with the highest conversion rate. But at the same time, what I would call the lowest ethical burden. So I don't want to go to bed at night thinking, I've been pushing this person. That's a horrible feeling to have. Right? You want to go bed at night, be like, I'm helping this person. And this has always been the differentiator between great salespeople and average or poor ones, is that you're actually trying to do good for others instead of doing good for yourself first. And that's, I think, the big differentiator.
It sounds very profound, the ethical side of it that you just said. Now, who do you think was the greatest salesperson in history?
If you historically look at very good salespeople, you never think of good salespeople. Like, you're probably thinking about Jordan Belfort or people like that, that are just like very pushy tactics. If I had to think about the best salespeople, I would probably look at people like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, because they had that message and vision of what people really desperately needed, but they have an extremely non-pushy way about it. I think Gandhi's probably the best salesperson ever, because he was if he had done anything differently, so if he tried to force his hand with the British, he would have been screwed because he was never going to win an open fight. But because he decided to take the opposite route, the non-violent approach, he actually got the best results. And it's why he's remembered, right? Because he was so different. So I think generally, like, good salespeople do things differently from the others. If everyone is being pushy, then you want to be the opposite. So yeah, I would say, but this is a very unconventional answer, but that's the type of person you need to think about as a salesperson, because they are, at the end of the day, selling their ideas, their beliefs to someone. They're trying to change someone's mind. And the way in which they go about it is that they were helping the person change their minds. And that's really the crucial part. You can't change anyone's mind. You can only help them change their minds.
Wow, that was a really controversial answer. I didn't expect when you came up with Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
Absolutely.
But I can see why. Now, with that in mind, with this ethical approach and to level with people and find a common ground with them in a non-conflicting way, because that's what Gandhi's strength was. He didn't want to initiate conflict. He wanted to find a peaceful, mutual solution, rather, which he beautifully executed. Interesting. Wouldn't have thought of him as a salesperson, though, until you just said that. So does he inspire you in your work?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I'm not that ethical. I'm not such an incredibly nice person, to be honest. But I would say if when you want to think about salespeople, you want to think a disruptor. Probably another name that came to my mind, I didn't want to go with him because I'm not such a big fan, but it would have been Steve Jobs. And it's because Steve Jobs was, let's say, almost madly driven to fix the problems with the user interface, to fix the problem with having something that people actually wanted, right? Because BlackBerry was a crap phone, let's be honest. Then the touch screen comes along and you're like, why the hell am I looking at buttons? But again, he was also fixing a need and he has this big idea. Now, all of these guys are more like disruptor influencers, etc. But the overall mentality you should be having is, if I do something that's so good, people are going to be happy to have, then you are doing your job right as a salesperson. That would be the thinking.
So customer first, it's the end user in mind first. Is that what you're saying?
Look, I'm a cold calling trainer, right? So like, I specifically help with the cold calling. And the first thing I say is, you don't want to cold call the rest of your life. Do you want a cold call because you want to develop the sales skills, because you're not going to develop them by writing emails, that's for sure. And you want to develop the actual communication skills, but the logic is you're going to build such a good customer base, then you don't need to do prospecting afterwards. If you look at all the biggest players in the world, they don't prospect. They build a brand around the fact that they can just get constant return on whatever they've been doing. So that's the place that you want to be within your area. And this is why the first few years of building a business are so hard, because you're going to have to do things like cold calling, even if you don't want to.
So before we move into the other side, because I'm really interested about the development of the sales representatives, you mentioned that you're a cold calling sales trainer. So this platform that we're on now is Coach Professionally. So how is coaching and training, or what you do, connected?
Let's put it this way. I think everyone, if they really want, they can learn cold calling. It's like learning a language. You can do it. But it's a pain, which is why people pay coaches and trainers. So, for example, I've decided to build out a Wikipedia just for cold calling. And it's got just a bunch of cold calling knowledge that's freely available for people, so they can at least get hit the ground running. And then moving from there, the next stage is, you might want to get a coach or a trainer to become better. And so that's how the two things connect in my world.
Thanks for explaining that. So basically, you're facilitating people learning by themselves by giving them all the materials so they can self-train. And then you help them to fill the skill gaps by training and coaching them in getting better.
My biggest source of income is sales training. My biggest cost is sales training. In the sense that I'm always looking to learn new things, I'm always looking to practice other things I don't know, etc. And the one thing I've realized very quickly in my career is that you can do things on your own and it will take you X amount of time. If you're not too unlucky, you can pay someone and it's going to take you a fraction of that time. So you're trading your money for time. I can always make more money. I can never make more time. And so that's why I would say every coach out there should be doing it. Think about it this way. They should be first investing to get their business up and running, but then figuring out that what they want to do is they want to trade at a much higher value their time for money than the other way around.
This is golden. I 100% agree with you. What you just said there, even the richest person in the world, it doesn't matter whether you're Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, you only have 24 hours a day and you cannot make more time. That's it. So if you want to mess about with doing everything by yourself, it will take you this much. If you're going to get help, then it will take you this much. It's just how much of your time do you want to spend on procrastinating rather than doing the actual thing that you really want to do?
Look, there are certain things like that you're going to enjoy doing and you want to do. For example, like I sometimes get contacted by ghostwriters telling me, do you want me to write for your LinkedIn? And I'm like, no, I like writing for my LinkedIn. I recently had a video editor and then I'm like, I actually quite like video editing, like at least a small part of it. So I think some things you want to do yourself because it makes sense. I will never get someone to cold call on my behalf because that would be insane. That's my business card, is the cold call. Whether you like it or not, it's whether you're going to decide to have a conversation with me or not. But there are, I think the rest, like website, marketing, graphics, those things, I could learn them. It'd take me hundreds of hours, or I can just outsource it. And that's what I do.
So it's interesting that you said that you like creating your LinkedIn posts, and they are fantastic. They look really authentic. I can tell that you put your heart into those, like you're really present there. You said you got into video editing now. I wonder if you were fully booked, would you still do all these things or would you offload some of it?
I think if I'm fully booked, I'm not charging enough. I recently turned down like the biggest deal of my career, which was 10K plus, probably 15, 20. And it's because, first of all, the pay rate wasn't that good. It was just a lot of hours. But then I thought I can either trade my time with this person or I can try to get a much higher value deal for my time. And so like my idea is never going to be doing more than 2, maybe 3 hours a day of training. The rest of the time is spent business building. There should never be a point where I much rather prospect harder to get higher value deals in than to service a lot of very low value deals, because you're going to end up creating a low value customer base. And then it's just a recipe for burnout and just not scaling the business properly.
Yeah, it's also true that you cannot coach for 8 hours a day. That's just simply impossible. Like you cannot wear so many different hats and be on point with every single client. So you cannot serve and deliver value to, say, 8 clients a day separately or individually. It just doesn't work.
100%.
Now, let's dwell into the business developers or the sales development manager, SDRs, you call them. What does SDR stand for again?
It's sales development representative, but really, it's anyone that's doing the frontline sales. I would argue that most founders are SDRs. If you're the founder of your business and you're sending emails, LinkedIn, calling, you're an SDR as well. And it's very important to keep that in mind because it means you'll have a different outlook on your business as well.
And that's why you mentioned Steve Jobs as well earlier as a great salesperson, which he really was, because he touched the hearts and minds of people with his sales message, definitely, with his obsession, rather.
The similarity there is that Steve Jobs wasn't scared of doing the dirty work. He wasn't scared of getting into the nitty-gritty and looking at where the materials were coming from, how the design looked, And I would say it's very similar. Like I, whenever I talk to founders of small companies, for me, it's an immediate red flag if they don't want to get on the phone. I'm like, you don't believe in your product enough that you would like to talk to strangers about it. That's a very big problem in my eyes.
Well, why do you think people have this resistance towards the cold calling or just ringing people randomly?
Look, I've just an informed opinion. Two reasons that come to mind immediately. First of all, our brain is wired against social rejection, simply because that meant death when our reptilian brain and the monkey brain developed. If you were rejected by your group, you would die. That's why the human is a social animal. So that's the reason number one. And that's the reason why, if you ask anyone, they will remember the one time they were picked last for football, but they're probably not going to remember all the times they were slapped in the face. Because emotional pain is so much higher in the scale of pain compared to physical, right? So that's reason number one, is that your brain literally doesn't like it. So whenever someone says no, you will take it personally. I still do. There are some times that I have a bad call and I'll need to maybe walk off for a minute before I can get back on the phone, because like my brain is coping with that. And the other reason is because, and this is something I've heard a lot about, which would make sense, is that when you're a kid, you tend to be told to not talk to strangers. You've got this idea that like you talk to the people in your circle. So the idea of picking up the phone and talking to a stranger for most people is completely unthinkable. Like literally, I Googled the other day, or I ChatGPT the other day. I think there's in the planet, there's something like 100 million people that make cold calls, or maybe even less now. Maybe it's 50. I can't remember. So that's a very small fraction of the planet that's ever made a cold call in their life. Right? Most people just could never think about it. When I tell people what I do, they're like, oh my God, how do you do that? And that's because your brain thinks it's weird.
That's mind-blowing. I never thought about the numbers, how many people actually made a cold call in their lives. I used to do prank calls when I was a kid. I remember I wasn't allowed to talk to strangers either, but I used to do prank calls when our landline was installed. It was funny ringing random numbers and saying some silly stuff. We used to have a lot of fun with that as kids, and people found it really annoying.
It's actually interesting, because I was thinking about this literally today. I just sent out my newsletter. And I think people make this a lot harder than it is, because they're not trying to have fun with it. And you're going to do a lot of crappy stuff in your life. You decide whether you're going to do it having fun with it or not. So why not try to have some fun with it if you're going to have to do it? That would be my overall thinking.
Yeah, I watch your TikTok videos, and some of them are really funny, actually. Some of the responses, it really shows that you walk the walk when you say that.
How can I say it can get boring. And I think this is the reason why I wear the gold. It's not because yellow is my favorite color. It's because you always want to stand out no matter what it is that you do. And this is why the white hat said the gold vest, it's become like a little bit my brand. And whenever people scroll and watch a video, they're like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? Why is he dressed like that? And he stands out. And this is probably the first thing I would say to everyone that's trying to sell, is try to stand out. Don't be like everyone else. I've seen recently, I worked with a lot of recruitment agencies, and if you go to their website, they all say the same thing. We're ethical, blah, blah, blah. And all the websites look the same. And if I saw one that said like, oh, we treat our candidates all right, I think that would stand out so much more. Little things like that. So probably more marketing than sales that.
It's good advice to stand out. That's how you get noticed. And if people don't know about you, they can't possibly buy from you.
Absolutely. And if people think I look stupid, fine. I don't need to please everyone. I'm not pizza, you know?
I've seen a lot of hideous things on the internet lately, like these big hats are becoming a trend for social media influencers, and they try to stand out by wearing a big hideous hat. It's funny. Anyhow, obviously, even in social interactions, if you go to a networking event or if you just go to a dinner party, sometimes talking to a stranger can be nerve-wracking. To a new SDR or somebody who is having this resistance of picking up the phone daily and making those calls and possibly being rejected several times over and over again. What do you advise them? What tips do you have for them?
The first thing I tell anyone that's starting is to do what I call a like a pyramid process, in the sense of like gradually increasing the amount. So it's okay even for the first day to have one conversation. That's fine, because you'll feel awkward. The second day, you're going to want to have two. The third day, you're going to have three. And then this is all you do. This is actually science behind the habit building. You just try to build a consistent habit by slowly increasing it. I, for example, do 10 conversations every day. I actually have it written here, like you can't see, but this is like the number. I've been now cold calling for 37 straight working days. And I write that down because the more I do it, that just helps me to build out that consistency. So what I would say, the first thing is build out very simple milestones that you cannot miss. So as in, they're so simple that you can't miss them. And then slowly, the habit will kick in and you won't even realize that you start doing it. I'm at the point now that it actually doesn't bother me anymore. I don't have that fear. Oh, I need to call people. Oh, yeah, I'm going to call some people, whatever.
I see on the whiteboard behind you that you have a number with rejections written above it. What does that mean?
This is something I came up with. When I quit my corporate job, I thought I was the best salesperson on the planet. It turns out I wasn't, sadly. And so I went on a journey to become a better salesperson. And I learned from some very good people in the business. And that's where I developed my whole idea of like how you do sales. Because I used to be a pushy type of salesperson. Well, not pushy, but I used to be like trying to handle people's objection rather than getting them to think about it. And so I came up with a challenge for myself, which is I'm going to get 3,000 rejections on cold calls. And for those that cold call, that means 3,000 conversations. I'm on a journey now. I'm just close to, I think, I'm going to pass 1,800 next, 1,800 left next week. So that means like I'm just about to be 1,200. And so once I'm going to be done with that, there's a very good chance I'm going to have a much different outlook on what rejection means as well.
So you still haven't told us how to handle these rejections.
Honestly, I think this is a question like, what's the meaning of life? In the sense that everyone has got to come up with their own coping mechanism. There are some tips like that you can use. I think, again, the consistency is the best way, because you're going to get used to it. It's a little bit like getting used to waking up in the morning or taking a cold shower. Eventually, your brain understands it's normal and they stop panicking every time it happens. I would say like probably writing out the problems. So like when you have a really bad conversation, writing out about it really helps. Another thing that really helps is laughing. If you just had something really bad, just have a funny video. Laugh immediately kills pain. It is the best painkiller available in nature. So I think laughing as well will help. But the only one thing that's going to help you handle this really is the consistency. So building it out over time to the point that you are numb to it. That's really the only way.
So in your experience, what are the top five things that new salespeople struggle with?
So the biggest problem at the beginning is that because it's tiring mentally, you're going to often cut away before having finished. And that's the first recommendation, is if you're going to get yourself X amount of things done, just get them done, establish the outcome, the input before, and then get it done. So first of all, getting the work done. Secondly, is the focus switching from themselves to the prospect. We already had this conversation, so I'm not going to ask you the question again, but I will for the sake of the audience. What do you think is every person's favorite topic, Mike?
Themselves.
Absolutely. You are the favorite hero of your story. So the more you're talking about yourself, your product, etc., rather than the problems you fix or what you can do for them, the more likely you are to trigger resistance. So switching from me to them, it's extremely important. Then I would say talking too much, which kind of falls into this category. Most people think you need to fill the silence all the time, and you really don't. The fourth one is then building out good habits. So like, when are you going to prospect? When are you going to do admin? When are you going to do this? So having a good day plan, I think it's something that every salesperson and founder could work, could use help with. Finally, is actually not taking care of the work outside. So in the sense that when I was a junior salesperson, I was lucky. I started to make money relatively quickly. And I started justifying, because I make a lot of money and my job is stressful, I'm allowed to do whatever I want with the rest of my life, which led to a lot of alcohol, like not a lot of sleep, not prioritizing physical exercise. And all these things eventually come knocking. So I would say making sure the rest of your life also makes sense is very important.
That's another great piece of advice right there, to take care of yourself and consider your future. Very good. If a person doesn't have a problem picking up the phone, they're making the calls, they're hustling, something's still not working, what are your top three hacks? Let's say, what time to call? What time is the best time to call a prospect or something like that?
I mean, look, this is one of those questions. Like, what's cold caller's favorite topic, Mike?
What's their favorite topic? Themselves?
Yes, that is. But it's the opener. What's the best opener? Which is the equivalent that most people will get to. It's like thinking about having a chat-up line for Tinder or for dating that will always work. And that's just complete nonsense. But so what I would say, there's a lot of these things like, what's the best time to call, etc. I personally think the most important thing is that you should call when you're comfortable calling. That's number one. There's a lot of statistics behind that. The best time to call is 4 to 5 p.m. But I've got stuff to do at 4 to 5 p.m. So I never call. I always call typically 10 to 12, 12 to 12:30 a.m. But I would say if I had to pick one day of the week that I always prefer to call, is Friday afternoon.
Friday afternoon is the best time for cold calls, you say?
I don't know what it is, but pickup rate goes through the roof. Obviously, I know what it is. People are not working that much. People are more relaxed. They are generally like in that type of whatever. Like it's so. I think, especially if you hit them with something like that, I'll be completely honest, it's a Friday afternoon cold call. There's a good chance you're gonna get like some good responses out of it.
That's super interesting, because if you are like in business operations, let's say, they say never to send emails on Friday afternoon because they get forgotten by Monday. So usually the Friday afternoon email batch that you would send out, you save until Monday morning and you send it out in the beginning of the week.
But that's the difference between emails and cold calling. If someone is going to pick up the call, they can't ignore it, can they?
What I'm saying is, does that result in actual follow-ups? And you have a conversation Friday afternoon, what happens on Monday?
Look, not the last meeting I booked, because I booked a meeting today, but the one before that was on Friday afternoon.
Cool. So Friday afternoon, and you scheduled the meeting for the week ahead.
I had it. It was the call just before this one.
Wow. Amazing.
And it was funny because it was my very last call. The person called me back after I called them. And I literally was out of the office. I was like, you know what? I'm going to put the headset on because I've been chasing this person. And then boom. And so, yeah, Friday afternoon, definitely. But I would say I usually call every day 10 to 12. And then on Friday afternoon, I always leave myself another slot to call, to catch up on calls, because I know it's a very good time to get follow-ups and pick up calls.
And do you leave voicemails when people don't pick up?
This is like quite the in detail topic. I've got, I do multi-channel still. So like I typically call as a follow-up. I'll have a voicemail pointing to a LinkedIn connection request I send just to build familiarity. Then I'll send SMS, and I'm actually going to implement some emails sometime next week, but they're all going to be emails references my phone call. So it's going to be like, hey, I left your voicemail. I'm going to try to call you again tomorrow. And this is just to get people accustomed to who I am, why I'm calling.
Sounds really interesting. Now, what's next for you? If somebody is interested about working with you, what's the best way to find you, and what have you got going on?
So at the moment, I literally just launched my bootcamp. So it's going to be the very first like bootcamp directly for salespeople and recruiters on cold calling, which is running for 12 weeks starting the 3rd of April. so that there'll be, I'm assuming you're going to put a link to my profile, be quite accessible from that. Alternatively, if there's a, it's a company looking for training or looking to implement or improve their cold calling, they can obviously reach out and schedule a call and we can discuss that further.
Cool. So what's your main social media channel? Where should people follow you if they want to learn more about how to call better?
I post on LinkedIn every day, including Saturday and Sunday. So LinkedIn obviously is going to be the main one. However, TikTok is growing quite massively. And if people prefer video content, I post a video every working day on TikTok as well.
Thank you, Giulio. It was great having you on the podcast. And I found it really interesting to hear about your empathic approach more in detail and how much psychology actually goes into it, how much consideration for the other person. That's just fascinating, always.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Obviously, always a pleasure.